when they're in fact icy. And that's what we have come to describe in Colorado as black ice. Those are foreseeable conditions, and if we lose control, we're negligent. We're not entitled to a sudden emergency instruction. No testimony in this case about black ice. In fact, the testimony from the police officer, as I alluded, is that these were typical winter driving conditions and nothing was unexpected. The sudden emergency instruction is only available to a defendant when there are truly an unexpected emergency brought on by someone else or something else, not road conditions.
Mr. Garson, you've been pretty clear that you associate the sudden emergency with unforeseeability in your argument today. Insofar as icy roads in Colorado are concerned, how do you draw the line? Is there a place where it would not be foreseeable? And where is that line where it then is foreseeable? Now, I understand here you're talking about time of year, plaintiff's own testimony about the wet conditions and cold conditions. And so I think I understand your argument is that's foreseeable under these circumstances. Is it always in Colorado, or is there a line somewhere?
That's a very difficult question, Your Honor. I've tried to tackle that one. The police officer in this case said to me, well, if it had been a freezing cold morning and a fire hydrant had broken and spilled water out over the roadway and there was no ice, no slick roads anywhere else but in that one spot because of a fire hydrant leaking onto the roadway, perhaps that could be considered something unforeseeable, therefore an emergency. I mean, another question I think we have to ask ourselves is, well, did anybody else lose control that morning? Was this such a dangerous and unforeseeable road condition that other drivers were unable to maintain control? Because then we might say, well, if there's 10 cars out of control, 10 drivers lose control, then we might have to ask ourselves, is it an emergency condition? Because it would appear, if those were the facts, that it was unforeseeable. However, here we have the overwhelming evidence that this is a typical Colorado road condition. Therefore, the only conclusion is this defendant was going too fast for conditions.
Mr. Garson, I have one of these cars where this little light goes on. Sometimes it says icy road. I doubt the car is actually detecting ice on the road, be it black or otherwise. I imagine it's detecting temperature. I don't know. But my question to you is cold temperature and wet weather, is that therefore foreseeable of ice on the road?
6:30 in the morning on a February morning, early February morning, when it's been drizzling the night before, when the police officer says it started snowing at 3 or 4 in the morning throughout the area, the roads everywhere were the same, when that's the same testimony from another witness, absolutely foreseeable that if you are approaching an intersection, you have to take extra care because what happened here? What is the emergency? Is the emergency here the red light? If there's no red light, there's no emergency. If she doesn't lose control unless she fails to be able to stop for a red light.
So let me understand your argument a little better. Are you saying at some point that this is a question of law for the court to determine as opposed to a question of fact? And that is what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying, Your Honor, because it's incumbent upon the trial court as a matter of law to properly instruct a jury. And the determination of what's a proper instruction is fundamentally a legal question for the trial court. And in these instances, you know that I've argued here, there's no competent evidence of an emergency. The fundamental rule established by Young v. Clark is there must be competent evidence of an emergency, number one, and the person claiming the emergency cannot have created the emergency through their own negligence. Now, that has to be a threshold that's determined by the trial court. In this case, I submit, the trial court blew it, opened the door for what turned out to be jury misconduct in the juror foreperson bringing in evidence of reaction time, and the trial court further blew it when the judge did not instruct on res ipsa loquitur, on the presumption instruction, because these facts and circumstances spell out a presumptive case of negligence.
Let's, if you don't mind, let's switch to this idea of the jury misconduct.
Happy to, Your Honor.
You say the judge blew it by not giving a sudden emergency instruction, so I guess your argument then follows that the jury, and particularly an engineer who was on the jury, a woman who was an engineer, was she the foreperson?
That's what happened, Your Honor, yes.
She basically performed her own calculations.
What we understand from the affidavit that we have from the investigation we did from two separate jurors is the foreperson introduced into deliberations concept of reaction time. What is reaction time and how it factors into the equation of defendant's driving?
I guess my question is this concept of reaction time a formula? What is it exactly? Did she have to go to some book to look up a formula, and then did she bring that formula into the jury room, or alternatively, did she just happen to know this as part of her general knowledge?
She would have had to have consulted something authoritative in order to introduce what is reaction time. It would have had to have been some specialized knowledge that would come from some authoritative source.
But it's a specialized knowledge you would have gained in college, for example.
Well, Not Your Honor, I...
Anybody else's specialized knowledge is by virtue of having an education, going to school?
One of the difficulties here, Your Honor, is that we were not given an opportunity to investigate those facts and to determine. We asked the trial court for an opportunity to delve into that issue, to determine those things. So we'd be speculating. But I believe you can distinguish what is general knowledge from the introduction of what I've called accident reconstruction evidence into the jury deliberations, where the plaintiff has no opportunity to cross-examine that evidence or to comment on that evidence. That is evidence.
Mr. Garson, didn't you have an opportunity to voir dire that particular juror and also have an opportunity to preempt that juror and run the risk of having that juror have some information or have some expertise naturally?
Well, Your Honor, I was given half an hour to voir dire something on the order of 17 people. So as I mentioned before the Court of Appeals, it was about a minute and a half per person. And no, she hid herself as an engineer.
I mean, it wasn't listed as her occupation?
Correct.
Her training and education?
Correct.
You didn't have any information?
None of that. She indicated that she had had a master's degree, and it was in... It was veiled. She did not reveal herself to be an engineer until after the jury verdict.
What was the master's degree?
I don't recall, Your Honor. Mathematics, I think she said.
Well, the deliberations of the jury are not to be exposed. So, you know, our cases, don't they require that the affidavit allege in some way, or that some extraneous material was brought into the jury room? Otherwise, isn't it absolutely privileged, the deliberation of the jury?
Well, that's been the comment, and we do obviously need to preserve the deliberation of the jurors, but the indication we have is that they violated their oath to consider only the evidence in the case.
That wasn't my question. My question was the juror that apparently made some sort of statement, did she or he say that something was brought into the jury room, that the internet was used, that some kind of book was used? Is there any
no Bible was allegation? Brought? No, Your Honor. There's no allegation of that.
So it's the mental processes of the jury in deliberation, basically.
Well, I think that what we would have, my belief is what we would have developed is if we were able to contact this juror, she would say, yes, the night before I read a book, consulted one of my books on reaction time, and went back to study some of this scientific evidence, and I came and I brought it into the jury room. The actual physical bringing of a book is not what the test is. It's the information that's imparted to the jury, in this case, from the foreperson, that's beyond anything that was in the evidence.
I'm sorry, I missed that just a little. Did you say you assumed that would be the case, or did you say it was the case that she consulted outside sources?
I assumed we would have been able to develop it in that way, Your Honor. I'm speculating as to what would happen. We weren't given an opportunity.
And would your feeling be different about the whole matter if you were able to explore that and it turned out she did not consult outside sources, but she just remembered this technique or this mathematical formula or whatever she did?
I still think it violates her oath to consider only the evidence, that when she says, this is what reaction times are, and let's do a calculation based on reaction time, when there hasn't been any evidence of that, then you're creating evidence.
But she used the facts that were present in the trial, right? I mean, there's no question about that.
What did she use for reaction?
Evidence.
What did she use for reaction time?
Whatever the testimony was.
What is the human reaction time? Who knows?
And is it because this involved numbers or some kind of a quantified formula that it's bothersome to you? Would it be the same if she just said, from my experience, I'm 75 years old, I've been watching people for a long time, and I don't think anybody could have reacted faster than this. Would that have been okay?
I don't know how to answer that, Your Honor. I think yes. I mean, I think, you know, if you're talking about the just general discussion of, I don't think anybody would have been able to do this or that. I mean, let's not forget, we're doing this in the context of what I contend is an erroneous sudden emergency instruction. And it dovetails, this issue of juror misconduct very clearly dovetails with the erroneous use of the sudden emergency doctrine.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you a little bit more about. Why do you think the sudden emergency instruction makes your second argument about the jury more telling or more compelling? Because doesn't the sudden emergency instruction just change the way you evaluate the negligence of the defendant?
Legally? In theory it does, Your Honor, but in practice it doesn't, and that's what Justice Lohr was getting at in his dissent in Young v. Clark, and I would look at it the opposite of how you just framed it.
Okay.
I think the fact that there is jury misconduct, or at least an indication of jury misconduct, leads us to go back and say the sudden emergency instruction never should have been given in the first place. I think, yes, the fact that it was given and the fact that it was implied to the jury there was an emergency started them down the slippery slope of looking at reaction times, thanks to the engineer foreperson. But I think the strong argument, the one we keep coming back to here, and I believe this is a case of res ipsa loquitur, I believe the thing speaks for itself here, but nevertheless, the court should not have instructed on sudden emergency.
Mr. Garson, how would you draw the line if you were writing the opinion for us about how this case constitutes jury misconduct. So that not only would solve your problem, which is reversal, but would be something that other that courts could use in the future. How would you define it?
That specialized knowledge brought into a jury room by a juror violates their oath to consider only the evidence.
And then how would you define specialized knowledge?
Right.
Something that someone wouldn't have learned in high school, something that someone wouldn't have learned in college, if they were a philosophy major, if they were an engineer major. That's a slippery slope, isn't it?
Well, and that's where it gets tough when it's engineering principles. I think we're talking engineering principles here.
Well, what about medical?
Go ahead.
What about medical? Excuse me, medical background? What about various professions that people have that give them special insights into all kinds of problems?
I think it may
have nothing to do with specialized education, but would be specialized knowledge. That's a pretty broad, we might not have any jurors.
Well, they have to be very careful not to introduce evidence. I mean, if it's a medical malpractice case and there's a doctor on the jury, which we all know is not going to happen, but if that doctor starts discussing their medical background and what they know about the particular allegations of the case, they're bringing in evidence.
You really want to examine the whole course of the deliberation and to see what was discussed between the jurors, right? You want to, in effect, mic the jury, you know, to make sure they don't use the specialized knowledge.
I certainly understand your concern, Your Honor. That's not what I'm proposing. I think that there is a threshold that was met here that we should have been able to find out more about what's going on.
Well, what you're really concerned about is the lack of voir dire. I mean, that's what this boils down to if we analyze it. You don't mind having jurors who are educated or knowledgeable. You just want to know about it.
I do personally very deeply believe, Your Honor, that limiting counsel to a half hour of voir dire when there's 17 people to be interviewed, it leaves, it's just not fair.
So if the issue really is your knowledge about the specialized knowledge of jurors, it doesn't make sense to approach it from backwards, from the other end, if you will, saying we should keep people who have specialized jurors off the jury. We want intelligent, well-educated people to be jurors. Don't we?
Correct. Of course we do.
So do you understand what I'm saying? You're approaching it backwards.
I do. I understand that.
All right.
And, Your Honors, I'm going to defer for 5 minutes to my colleague, Mr. Neville, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal or 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
You may.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Neville. I'm here on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. And I would like to focus my discussion on the sudden emergency doctrine here.
Mr. Neville, could I just ask you to step closer to the mics?
Thanks. Certainly, Your Honor. The sudden emergency doctrine is appropriate in situations where a sudden and unforeseeable event leads to the occurrence of an accident. Unfortunately, under the facts present here, there was nothing sudden or unforeseen in the icy conditions of the roadway. As the defendant testified, it was raining the evening before the accident. It was early February in Fort Collins, Colorado. This is a situation that almost inevitably leads up to a lengthened, icy, and slippery commute in the morning. And because of that, this trial court should not have given a sudden emergency doctrine instruction.
Mr. Neville, I wanted to ask, she said basically that she didn't encounter any snow coming from the north. Was there evidence, or the roads were not? Is there evidence to counter that particular statement or not?
Your Honor, her testimony was that she had, that it had been raining before she went to bed, that the roads were wet, but she didn't feel that they were terribly slippery. On her way leading up to the accident site. But even wet roads are roads that are more slippery than dry roads and create an increased risk of loss of control. As the case law that we cited in our brief discusses, when you've got rainy roads or you've got icy roads, it is foreseeable that you will lose control and leave the traveled portion of the roadway.
Is it your position that weather can never be a sudden emergency?
No, Your Honor, it isn't. But I would qualify that. If it deals with a situation where there is long-standing weather conditions, as we had present here, then I would argue that, no, there shouldn't be a weather or sudden emergency instruction. However, in a situation where you're dealing with a flash flood or where you're dealing with perhaps icy roads that are in the shadow of a mountainside so that they're not getting direct sunshine and therefore not thawing and melting, those are situations where a sudden emergency instruction might be appropriate because they don't have this sort of ongoing condition that precipitation creates.
Could I ask, so does your argument amount to saying that the evidence was such that the judge should have simply taken the question of negligent driving away from the jury? That your argument about not giving this emergency instruction, if I understand it right, is because the emergency, if you want to call it that, was caused by the negligence of the driver. There wasn't even sufficient evidence that the jury should get to determine whether she was driving negligently. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that whenever anybody is driving on an icy road, there is a possibility that they could drive reasonably and prudently and not get into an accident. There's also the possibility that they could drive negligently and get into an accident. But the giving of the sudden emergency instruction in this situation was inappropriate because the claimed sudden emergency was neither sudden nor unexpected. And so that served to lower the standard of care further than that which a reasonable and prudent person would have to exercise under normal circumstances. And that was the error here.
And so by unexpected, is expected the same thing as foreseeable? So you're saying this was foreseeable?
Correct.
So she, and is that different from saying she drove negligently?
I think it is different, Your Honor. Because again, what we're dealing with, there are two different kinds of foreseeability that we deal with in negligence cases. The first kind of negligence is the negligence that a trial court must consider in establishing what the duty that is owed by the driver to the plaintiff is. And then there's the probable or the proximate cause foreseeability, which is a question for the jury. And while these two threads of foreseeability often become interwoven, my focus is really on that purely legal question of the duty that is owed to others around us. And in that context, it's a purely legal question for the trial court. And because there is not a sufficient showing of unforeseeability here, the giving of the instruction was error because it served to lower the standard of care for that driver. The jury still has the ability to evaluate the situation and determine that from its perspective, this was an unforeseeable situation, and therefore there was no proximate causation. And that's a question of fact for the jury that needs to be decided by the jury. I don't want to take that question away from the jury, but I want to make sure that we've pegged the standard of care at an appropriate level.
So just to follow up on that, is your theory then that just like a judge has to decide what duty someone owes to another, the judge has to decide whether that duty is limited in some way by a sudden emergency?
Yes,
and
Your
you
Honor.
Think that should be done prior to trial?
I do believe that.
And you
that
think
that
it should be done after a hearing?
No, I think it could be done before instructing the jury.
So the trial itself would be the hearing, essentially, as to what the duty standard is.
I believe, in effect, that would be correct. I mean,
and do you think that it, like your colleague said, it makes sense to allow testimony as to how many accidents there'd been at this intersection already that day, or other things of that sort in terms of deciding sudden emergency?
Your Honor, I think that takes us a little further afield into the specific fact-finding. I'm looking at this at a much more traditional duty analysis level. And, that kind of granular fact-finding might be a little bit too involved for a standard jury trial situation.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at. So what would be appropriate admissible evidence vis-a-vis the actual trial and yet still going to the issue of what the duty is?
Your Honor, I see I'm almost out of time, but I'd like to answer this question.
Please.
I think that the appropriate response is simply what we ask trial court judges to do all the time when they determine the scope of a duty that is owed, and that is to look at what a reasonable person under the circumstances would have foreseen. And in this case, a reasonable person under the circumstances would have foreseen the icy roads, and indeed this defendant did foresee those icy roads, and that didn't change her driving at all. I thank you. I see our time is up.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Troy Ukasik, and I represent the defendant, Holly Pippen, in the trial in this case and the appeal as well. I'll present my arguments in the order they were briefed in the briefs, starting with the sudden emergency instruction, which has seemed to garner most of the attention here this morning as well. The sudden emergency instruction is not a novel, brand new thing in the state of Colorado. It's been around for 60 plus years. It's been upheld, endorsed, and ratified by the Supreme Court on numerous occasions in the past. It's recognized in Colorado as on the CJI jury instruction, the quote-unquote stock jury instruction 9/11, and I think it's important that you read that instruction. It says a person who, through no fault of his or her own, is placed in a sudden emergency is
Mr. Kasich, if we assume for a minute that the IC conditions were foreseeable, doesn't this take you out of that instruction, just by definition?
If we assume they're foreseeable,
yes.
Potentially, yes. But in this particular case, what actually ended up happening in this case was there was testimony, to some extent exhaustive testimony, because this was my case at trial. This was my client's case. She left her home that morning about 4-plus miles away from the intersection where the accident happened. She made at least 7 or 8 turns. We went through a thing to figure if it was 7 or 8, but it was at least 7 or 8 turns. She had to stop. She had to make lane changes. She accelerated. And not once from the time that she left her house did she have any problem slipping, sliding, doing anything.
Well, that just focuses on her subjective experience, but what about the rest of the testimony about foreseeability, that it was snowy and icy conditions, it was early in the morning, it was freezing rain and that sort of thing. Plus, hundreds of people had gone through that intersection and not slid, gone through a red light and hopped over a median.
Right. Well, first, there was no evidence about that. What ends up happening is the people who testified that there weren't any accidents in that intersection were the people who showed up later. The witness from the employment that came by, the particular officer that did come to the scene, all the people that came in afterwards are seeing flashing police lights, they're seeing an accident's already happened there, they're going down to a different speed to handle the conditions at that intersection at that time. I think it is important that what happens subjectively to a person that comes up through that intersection as well, because that's the stimulus that driver has as they're going down the road.
So would it be your argument that two drivers approaching the same icy intersection might be in a different status with respect to sudden emergency if one of them went through 7 intersections with no ice and the other went through 1 intersection where there was a little ice?
Well, I guess potentially, because what we're looking at the time of this particular trial was what this particular person had experienced. And I guess
So if she just happened to go through the dry section and the other side is wet and dangerous, then for her it's a sudden emergency, even though for the rest of the town approaching from the other direction, it is not.
Well, yes, because that's what that person who's coming up to the intersection has experienced. I think that's exactly right.
So you have foreseeable as a very individual experience. So in your mind, in your view of this, the fact that it's winter, that it's Colorado, that it's cold, that it's wet, that icy roads are sometimes not consistent, those things don't really enter into play in her subjective experience, which results in this particular conclusion.
Oh, no, not at all, Your Honor. I think those things are all factors that go into it. And the whole point of the sudden emergency instruction is that if there's any dispute, if there's any issue between the parties as to what happened there, the question is whether the instruction should have been given. And in this particular case, it's not the fact that there either was or was not a sudden emergency. It's whether there was evidence presented to the court or the in evidence as to whether or not the instruction should be given. And sorry, I saw you sitting forward. And just by the fact that there was evidence of her subjective knowledge. And
well, of course, we're always talking about whether they're entitled to the instruction. And of course, beyond that, it's a question of fact. But you're saying that every defendant would be entitled to that based on their testimony, that despite the wintry conditions and icy conditions that everyone else experienced, they didn't experience any of that on the way to the accident.
Well, the one part of in this particular case is that the people who testified about the conditions at the intersection were all coming from the completely different direction. They were all my client was the only one that
I understand
came
that, but and that's where I was going initially, but it seems to me your argument's even broader, because you're saying to be entitled to the instruction, you only have to submit some evidence that it was your subjective, sudden, unexpected emergency. Therefore, if I testify contrary to everyone else that all the intersections I went through were dry, I'm entitled to the instruction.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think if the plaintiff had brought forth evidence that, no, Ms. Pippin, you're wrong. We have other drivers. We have meteorological evidence from your area that says that this was a icy road. It's incredible.
So then you would have the trial judge making a decision of credibility of witnesses as a part of determining which to believe and whether there's sufficient evidence of sudden emergency?
Absolutely not. It would be more of a sufficiency of evidence at all that existed. In this particular case, the only evidence that was in front of the court was...
Where this goes is I think that I would like you to try to explain to me why, if you make it a subjective experience, haven't you made it an issue of fact, not of law?
Well, it's an issue of fact as to whether you give the instruction, an issue of law whether you give the instruction.
And that's all I want to talk about, as to whether to give the instruction, when the consideration that you're suggesting is totally subjective, isn't it then a question of fact, not then of law, because you have different subjective experiences, and your trial judge is going to have to determine whether she had a credible subjective experience?
Well, I don't want to go down the road that I'm saying it's totally a subjective impression of the person. I'm saying in this particular case, that's where that was. But there could be other situations, such as the argument that Mr. Garson made, that if you're driving down the road, or the police officer discussed apparently, that if it's cold out but completely dry, and then somehow somebody's watering their lawn, or there's a fire hydrant that breaks and that goes out there, nobody would have any idea that was going to happen, potentially. But if somebody were to testify that, well, we all saw that and we drove through it anyway, then you wouldn't get that instruction, because you created that. That was some of your fault. In this particular case, I think when you're looking at, because the specific instruction says through no fault of his or her own, that's got to be a subjective issue, because you're the one who's experiencing it. It's directed towards that particular defendant. And I guess if there's evidence, and the specific law states that if there's a dispute, if there's inferences on both sides, if there's a dispute, it's not that it has to be an emergency, but if there's a dispute on it, the instruction needs to be given. And I think what the amicus counsel was talking about, that it lowers the standard, it doesn't lower the standard, because what the instruction specifically says is that you're chargeable with negligence if that person exercises the degree of care which a reasonable person would do.
Well, it sure seems to me, though, that the trial court has put the judge's thumb right on one side of the equation here, especially when you look at denying the presumption that if a car ends up in a totally different lane. I mean, here we have an innocent victim. I mean, you would concede that. In the lane that she's supposed to be in, a car comes hurtling over the median and causes property damage or personal injury. Now, the whole basis of the personal injury and property damage law is to provide compensation to innocent victims. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
All right. So why weren't they entitled at least to have, if the judge was going to give the emergency instruction, the presumption that if you're in your proper lane and somebody comes over and hits you and causes you injury, that there ought to be something on the other side where the jury has to explicitly deal with that issue?
Because there's two completely different analysis, Your Honor. On the sudden emergency instruction, that doesn't change the burden of proof of parties. It's a factor for the juries to consider. It's an apples and oranges argument. When you're getting into the res ipsa instruction, that actually presumptively changes the burden of proof in the case. It doesn't just give the jury a factor to consider. It says now the plaintiff does not have to prove that. The defendant now has to prove that they were not negligent.
Well, there's a little bit of a dispute about that, isn't there? The cases are really inconsistent about whether or not it's a burden of going forward or a burden of persuasion.
Well, the specific instruction that says that if, in this particular case, the one that was tendered was when the driver of a motor vehicle hits another which is stopped, the law presumes the driver was negligent. That's what was tendered in this particular case.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, if you're just sitting there, as Justice Hobbs says, and somebody else runs into you, just from a matter of common sense, it would make sense that it's not your fault, somebody else's fault, right?
In general, and potentially. But if I may answer, Your Honor, there's times when you're driving down the road within the speed limit, nice fine day, nothing can cause an accident, and a child pops out from a street. And you've then faced with the, I'm going to run the child down, or I'm going to swerve into a parked car, somebody that might be on the side. It's a split-second decision. That decision is, it's clear in Colorado that that's a sudden emergency, not created by the person. You're not just held a strict liability standard. And so it has to be based on the facts that are present in the case. And in the res ipsa loquitur instruction, essentially, when we're dealing with automobile accidents, is rarely ever appropriate because we have the people and the parties that can sit there and testify as to what happened. Res ipsa loquitur is more reserved for the situation, as the CDLA's amicus brief stated, like a natural gas explosion or some type of catastrophe where the catastrophe itself eliminates the evidence, excuse me, so you can't tell what happened, what the negligence was. That's a res ipsa loquitur situation because really if this natural gas explosion happens in a natural gas plant, it's presumed that that happened. But in an auto accident case, we've got parties that can tell what happened, and this law forever in Colorado has been the plaintiff holds that burden of proof to prove their case on that issue. And it doesn't just give a factor for the jury to consider like the sudden emergency, it actually changes that burden of proof.
Well, counsel, can I just stop you there, though? Haven't we recognized that res ipsa is appropriate in some instances in the auto context?
Some instances.
Okay, help me understand the limits of res ipsa in the auto context, in your opinion.
Well, you would have to completely eliminate any, according to the law, you'd have to eliminate any potential causes from the defendant's negligence. You sufficiently eliminate other causes besides the defendant's negligence. And so I guess I'd struggle to find a fact pattern specifically what it would be, maybe driving 90 miles an hour through a red light and then another red light, and you just keep driving through red lights and you hit somebody broadside going through an intersection. I'm trying to think of some fact pattern, but essentially in a case where this one here is, where there's been evidence showing that there were other causes potentially besides the defendant's negligence, it's not appropriate instruction. The plaintiff still holds that burden of proof.
Is that the right test? I thought it was in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
It is in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, but you have to
Why wasn't that true in this case, factually?
Well, because if under Minto versus Sprague, if there are any conflicting inferences, such as what was created by the defendant's testimony about what she experienced going up to this intersection, if there is a conflicting inference, there's no res ipsa instruction under Minto.
Well, so the result is the victim has no recourse.
No, that's not true. What the victim had was, the victim had recourse, went to trial, tried her case. The jury was instructed 31 different jury instructions. Numerous jury instructions talked about what the jury's obligation was as far as what standard of care was, what reasonableness was, what negligence was, what causation was, negligence per se, numerous instructions given. It wasn't like the jury was told you cannot find them negligent. The jury had the opportunity to listen to my client and say, you're full of it. You're not right. We don't believe you, and we're going to find for the plaintiff. She had recourse. The jury found for the defendant in the case. It ends up being no recourse because of the defense verdict, but that can happen in numerous situations where the victim's a 50-50 situation, where the plaintiff is 50% responsible and the defendant's 50% responsible. Under Colorado law, that victim would have no recourse either because the jury found in that particular way for that plaintiff or for that defendant.
In terms of, before you get going again, in terms of the relationship between these two instructions, the res ipsa loquitur instruction and then but also the sudden emergency, can you envision a situation in which it would be appropriate to give both? Or does giving the one necessarily preclude giving the other?
No, I don't. They're two completely separate analyses. I mean, I think you have to, under the law, you have to look at the facts under the sudden emergency instruction to determine whether or not there's any dispute there. Under the res ipsa loquitur instruction, if you, I suppose there could be a fact pattern that could be presented, which would also bring up a situation where you've eliminated any potential causes of the negligence.
And I
don't know what that would be right now.
If I can just narrow that down just with one more follow-up. So if it were appropriate to give a res ipsa loquitur instruction, in effect you'd be changing the burden.
Yes.
We presume
yes.
negligence here. This is a situation in which the driver was presumed to be negligent. Would it then at the same time be permissible, let's say in this kind of a situation with the ice, to say, but nevertheless, she was not at fault, and therefore we have the possibility of a sudden emergency instruction?
If an appropriate instruction were given that would say that it's a rebuttable presumption, then I guess that it would be appropriate because then you could then rebut it with evidence of the sudden emergency. In that situation. But in this particular situation, that's not the case in our particular case, but the concern we would have if you end up giving a res ipsa loquitur instruction under these facts is that this case gets cited in almost every auto accident case where this type of thing happens. One of the justices, I believe it's Justice Hobbs, asked the question about, well, she's an innocent victim, she's sitting where she's supposed to be, and somebody hits her, and it's not in her appropriate lane. Well, that's because she got there in response to the emergency. She got over there in response to an emergency. If that situation, there could be many factual situations, I guess, where somebody ends up getting over there and they're res ipsa instruction, so they don't have to burden of proof anymore. You still have to prove that case from the plaintiff's standpoint. That's why it's limited.
I need to get some clarification on that. I understood the test to be, for the second element of res ipsa loquitur, to be that the plaintiff must show that the defendant's lack of awareness of snow conditions and ice was more probable than the sudden appearance of the ice as she testified. So why, to me, that's whether you give us the second element of res ipsa loquitur, which is, I think, really a debate here. So why wasn't that so in this case, and why shouldn't it have been? I don't quite understand. Just because she said it otherwise, that doesn't make it more probable, given the evidence.
Well, it may, Your Honor, because
it
of
could.
What...
Yeah, whether it did that, in this case, and if you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, then the trial court should have given it seems to me.
Well, it doesn't. It's in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, but it doesn't mean ignore the evidence that's in front of the trial court. I mean, the trial court still had all this evidence in front of it about that trip that my client took from the north of the intersection to get down to it. That was still all there. So the court was actually left with a situation where there was not a sufficient elimination of other causes besides the defendant's negligence. There just wasn't an elimination of that. So the court really was in it had no choice but to not give the... If it would have given the res ipsa loquitur instruction, we're still here in the same spot. We're appealing it on our side because of the law that states that you can't give that instruction if there's any kind of minto that says if there's any conflicting inferences, you cannot
I'm
give
really
the instruction.
I'm really concerned that your argument is the bad weather defense now. If we write this opinion the way you want, anybody can claim it was bad weather that they didn't anticipate, and then Colorado citizens are going to get injured, and they're not going to have any recourse. So where do you draw the line on this?
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's already been decisions by the Supreme Court that deal with bad weather situations and the sudden emergency instruction. And so you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And that's what Your Honors have all decided in the other cases about. It's a case-by-case thing.
Well, why not just simply leave it to the law of negligence on both sides of the equation and let the jury decide under the standard of reasonable care that we each owe to each other when we get behind the wheel?
Well, it's for the exact arguments that a situation where somebody can get up and say, well, they were in their wrong lane. They were in the wrong lane and they hit me. They weren't even traveling in their right lane, where they got in that situation because of the sudden emergency itself. You're now, if my client, if the light would have stayed green, she would have just gone right through the intersection and not hit the plaintiff. She's in the wrong lane over a median because of the ice. That's how she got over there. If these were dry roads and she's just swerving down and changing lanes and hitting the defendant,
okay,
that's a different
story. Describe the emergency to me. Was there a car in the intersection that she would have hit if she didn't make this turn to the right when she starts then to go over the median because she doesn't successfully execute that?
Was
there somebody straight ahead of her?
There was nobody straight ahead of her at that time. Her concern that she testified at the trial was that if she hit the brakes and didn't get stopped before the intersection, she was going to slide out into that middle of the intersection and potentially cause an accident out in the middle of the intersection. And it's a split-second decision.
Were there any cars in the intersection?
No, she was the first one going through there. She was the first one going through. And it was a green light that just changed to yellow, so there was nobody coming from the other side, and she was the first one going through there.
But it's really her maneuver that causes this accident, right?
It's her maneuver in response to the emergency, to the ice that ended up resulting in the collision, yes.
The emergency is, I mean, under her point of view, that she's going to go through a red light, but there's no cars in front of her that she's going to hit.
Well, the emergency was after the light went from green to yellow and she hits her brakes and now is finding that she's on black ice and she can't stop, that's when she's in a situation where she has to react to that. I mean, the other choice, I guess, was going through the line.
I'm just trying to get your child analogy. Child comes out in the middle of the intersection, you know, that sounds like an emergency. But I don't hear the emergency in that apparently she could slide right through this intersection and cause no accident.
She could have slid through the intersection and caused no. If there had been no cars coming and she hit the brakes, she could have slid right through the intersection. If nobody came, it wouldn't have happened. She wasn't willing to take that chance. She wasn't sure what was going to happen there. And the question's not what the ending result ended up being. It's what got you to that point in the first place, how you reacted. And like I said before, the jury could have looked at this and said, Ms. Pippin, you should have just slammed on your brakes and gone right through the intersection. We're not believing this sudden emergency thing. We don't believe you have a legitimate claim. We're going to find in favor of the plaintiff. They found what she did to be a reasonable thing. It ends up being a question of fact, but it was a question of law to give the instruction.
Excuse me, counsel, but you used the terms black ice. I thought I understood opposing counsel to say there's no evidence of black ice in this case.
Well, I don't know that the actual words black.
Well,
Your
that's
Honor,
what
I
I'm asking you.
I can't remember.
Those are somewhat inflammatory words in the state of Colorado. So, were those words used in this case?
To tell you the truth, Your Honor, I cannot specifically remember if the words black ice were used or the road was wet and they came into some ice. I can't remember to tell you exactly what was said about that. I just don't remember from the trial, 2.5 years ago. So.
Could I talk to you a little bit about the juror?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you
yes,
tell me what is your understanding of exactly what this juror did? And I understand that you don't have a lot of factual basis on that, but what is your understanding, please?
My understanding or my position on what this juror did was looked at the evidence that was presented at the trial and did an analysis of the evidence, the speed, the distance, the time, the extent of the impact. There were photos that showed the impact wasn't that significant.
Did you actually have the evidence of the distance from wherever she was to?
Yes.
And how? What was that? Do you recall?
The evidence that came out of trial was that distance was about a 150-foot slide. It was part of the police officer's report, if I remember right. And there was evidence from my client that she was going 40 miles an hour. There was discussion about, even though it wasn't accident reconstruction discussion about what reaction times are, it's how long my client says, well, as soon as I saw this, I did X. So it was that type of test.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's the kind of stuff it was. And then there was a diagram, a blown-up diagram of the police officer's report that had distances marked out on it, and the officer got up and talked about it. There were even photographs that were taken of the scene from various angles showing the juror where everybody was. And so my position on what this juror did was looked at that, took her common everyday experience and said, this is a person going around 40 miles per hour. They slid 150 feet on ice. And we don't think she had enough time to react to do anything anything else besides what she did. And so there's no evidence at all, especially in the affidavit. There's nothing that Judge Schepansky, the trial court, had that would tell him that something from outside the jury room came into that jury deliberation. No internet, no television, no magazines, books, There's cases about the Bible and all those kinds of things. There wasn't like a accident reconstruction manual brought into this case. We had a juror who, my memory is the same as Mr. Garson's, that I think she was she had some kind of math background. And she ended up being the jury foreman in the case. And there was deliberation on the evidence, and they all came to that conclusion. There's just nothing else in the affidavit that would say, now if the affidavit had said she brought a textbook in and she did some analysis and put a calculation up on the board and here's what it was, I think we're looking at a completely different situation here. But what we have is somebody, as the Court of Appeals brought out, this is just, if we start saying we have to do 5 and 6 and 10 hour voir dires to get into the backgrounds of every single juror to figure out what they know, and then tell them once they go back there, forget everything you know and just go on these blank, rote, robotic agendas, then we're gonna have a tough time picking a jury. And we're also going to have a tough time, after every verdict, somebody's gonna be challenging, what did they do in there? What did they do in there? Did somebody bring in some specialized knowledge in there? I thought my case was pretty strong. I'm going to go interview these jurors, and we're going to bring up, this person actually used to be a car mechanic. He didn't tell us about it. It was 15, 20 years ago. But he was a car mechanic, and now we got this damage is a lot more than 30 miles an hour, so that guy's wrong, and I think you guys should believe me and not that accident reconstruction. We're opening up a Pandora's box as to what kind of analysis we're going to do of jurors' deliberations. And especially under this particular case where there's no allegation that an outside influence went into the jury room at all.
Let me take you back to the winter driving issue, the first issue. And we had a lot of discussion with opposing counsel about where you would draw the line. So let me ask you to answer that question. Where would you draw the line on winter, driving conditions in general?
When you asked the question, I thought the same. I figured I might get asked that same question. So, the one thing what I wrote down in my notes was kind of taking it at this approach. What was my client to do? Was she supposed?
Well, I would like you to take it out of these facts. Okay. We're trying to write an opinion for the case that you can't imagine right now. So, what should be the test?
Well, the test should be what the test is currently, is if there's any indicia or any evidence or dispute or credible evidence of a sudden emergency that exists, the instruction should go to the jury for as a factor for them to consider. I don't think there can be a bright line test on X number of speed or X number of distance or what kind of ice is out there. I just don't think there's a possible way to fashion that.
Doesn't your answer put sudden emergency into just about every winter accident that involves slipping on ice?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because if the situation was that my client was traveling, if there was evidence my client was going 15 miles an hour over the speed limit, and she was traveling right next to another car who was going a reasonable speed and they got stopped, and my client slid through an intersection and went and hit that person, I think as a judge you're like...
But see that, you shift things there, because now, I mean, the essence of the negligence here mm-hmm. is whether driving at what would otherwise be a normal speed is unsafe for conditions given icy road. That's the essence of the negligence question. Now you take it into a speeding contest or some other additional negligence, and then I think you shift the question. What I'm trying to focus at is with normal speed, with issues about anticipating icy road conditions, is that always a sudden emergency situation where that instruction would be something to which the defendant would be entitled?
If there's evidence that there was a credible evidence that the person was not anticipating that and it was sudden and unexpected to them, I believe so. Yes, absolutely. Such as this case or such as the other cases that the court has decided, if there's credible evidence that there was a sudden and unexpected emergency that was not created by that person, I think, yes, then it is a situation and a factor for the jury to consider, which is the reason for the doctrine in the first place.
You know, we teach our children when they're growing up and starting to learn how to drive to be defensive drivers, you know, to drive as if something bad is going to happen every time you get into the car. And that's kind of the standard of care that I suppose most parents want to see.
Sure.
What you're suggesting is that we should have a standard of care which is to drive as if you assume everything is going to be okay and as if there aren't going to be any problems. But then if there is a problem, then all of a sudden that's a sudden emergency and your standard of care is somehow lower. You don't have to drive quite as carefully because of that.
That's what I think is the misconception about sudden emergency. I don't think it's a lowering of the standard. It's a factor for the jury to consider. It's a factor for them to look at and say, okay, under this fact pattern, is that an appropriate, was that appropriate reaction? The jury could have looked at this exact same set of facts.
But, for example, if I was teaching my daughter how to drive, I'd say, you know, be careful, it's been rainy and it might be icy outside.
Absolutely.
And even if you don't find any ice, you know, in the first six turns, you continue to be careful because in my experience, there might be some ice out there. My daughter says to me, no, after six turns, I'm not going to be expecting any more ice. And if I run into it, it's not logical for me to expect that. And is that the way we really want to have people driving on our roads?
Absolutely not. I don't think that's what it's saying, Your Honor, if I may go past the time. It's a situation where I don't think there was any, it's kind of taking the step that Ms. Pippin on this day said, well, now that I've got through seven or eight turns, I don't have to worry about anything. It's not that that's what she was doing. It's that she went through those seven or eight turns and went that 20 minutes and four plus miles and thought, I'm driving at a speed that seems reasonable for these conditions. Because the question I said before, what was my client to do? When she went through those seven or eight turns and driving 5 miles under the speed limit as she's approaching the intersection, was she supposed to be 10 miles under the speed limit? 15 miles under the speed limit?
Thank you, counsel. I think we got the point.
Thank you.
We have time for one question. One statement, one question.
It does lower the standard. It should be an objective standard to determine whether the sudden emergency doctrine would apply. To apply it under these circumstances turns the rules of the road upside down. And despite Defense Lawyers Association's contentions, res ipsa loquitur should apply to these circumstances and probably should apply to most automobile accidents if you look at the three factors involved.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.